We are walking through the Schlauch, the route leading to the gas chambers of Sobibor, but we are walking in the opposite direction, back toward the tracks. We're wrapped up in our warm coats, and I can't help but thinking, no one walked this reverse direction back then. Whoever was to be gassed went via the curve in the road to the door of the gas chambers. No one could turn back from this point.
Even if it was cold, the prisoners had to hand over all their clothing. Standing by the sign Sobibor, we now know what that word implies, the significance of its weight. But the prisoners knew nothing. They saw fresh curtains behind the windows and neat wood carvings on the signposts. They heard music playing, and many people did not understand the reality of it all. Ornate things used against them. Deception.
We know now what it was like when you entered Sobibor, even though the Germans tried to keep the camp's existence a secret at the time. Prisoners revolted, they escaped and told the world what had happened. But nowadays, the people who survived Sobibor are no longer with us. The people who consciously experienced the war even as a child will soon be gone too. Who will tell what happened then, if there are no more eyewitnesses? Will the stories remain as poignant and personal still?
How do you tell the story of the war without the people from the war? That is what this episode is about. This is The Silence of Sobibor, in which we, Patty Lou Middeleenheer and Richard Grootbolt, podcast makers, Audiodrome Podcast Productions from the Netherlands, investigate the stories of Sobibor with the help of the Sobibor Foundation. This is episode 6, The Puzzle from the Past.
Is er ook wat een zaak met hek? Als je op mij niet komen genomen, dan ga ik schrikken. Dat is van mijn mama, en dat is van mijn vrouw, dat is van mijn zin.
Part of the interview with Haskil Mencher about the uprising. The famous quote, I stood in his blood and my heart was lighter. Only he said it in Yiddish.
Mijn hart is me geworden leichter als ik getreten in zijn bloed.
Haskil Mencher was one of the prisoners who managed to escape during the uprising and thus survived Sobibor. He's being interviewed here by Jules Schelvis. Jules also survived Sobibor, but only because he was taken to another camp as a forced laborer, only a few hours in Sobibor. He left his wife and family there. He realized how important eyewitness testimonies are, and he bought a video camera. He interviewed as many Sobibor survivors as possible.
And that was only the beginning. Jules wrote books, told his story on radio and TV programs, and gave lessons at school about Sobibor. He was one of the first in the Netherlands to see passing on information about Sobibor, and it was his life's mission. After him came others who also told their story and that of their family members.
Ik heb veel dingen niet gevraagd, zoals ik kinderen op school altijd zeg.
I didn't ask many things. As I always tell children at school, children have a built-in signal and they don't ask their parents about things they can estimate will cause grief. And so you don't ask at all.
Rudy Cortizos was born in 1939, just before the war broke out. He still regularly gives guest lessons about the war, using his own story as an example. His parents decided to go into hiding when Rudy was 3. He and his parents ended up at different addresses. He eventually went through 4 different hiding places. His mother and his grandfathers were gassed in Sobibor. He and his father survived. But just like his father, Rudy did not talk about the war often. That is to say, until he got older and memories of the past resurfaced.
In my leeftijdscategorie,
in my age group, at all times when you're together with Jewish friends, we had that yesterday afternoon together at the friend's place, we spoke for almost the entire afternoon about the Holocaust. As you get older and no longer have children to raise, as you're retired and have more free time, those years tend to surface much more often. Those moments like that, and then the whole film starts running inside. Emotion. And that's not just with me, it's with all of them.
Emotie. En dat is niet alleen bij mij. Dat is bij allemaal.
Rudy managed to uncover part of his own story and that of his family. Then came the day when all the news broadcasts were talking about Demjanjuk, the man suspected of collaborating in the deaths of tens of thousands in Sobibor, people like Rudy's mother.
Together with 20 other Holocaust survivors, he decided at the end of 2009 to attend the trial of John Demjanjuk, a Sobibor camp guard in Munich. It would become the most intense period of my life, says Rudy.
There were 200 journalists.
There were 200 journalists. There were 21 of us, plus our lawyers, etc. We were received and treated like kings and queens. That did the Germans credit. They did that, I must say that.
Dat ziet de Duitsers dat ze dat gedaan hebben, moet ik heel eerlijk zeggen.
Rudy has a letter that his mother wrote on the train to Sobibor. She threw it through the cracks in the wagon to the outside, and passers-by found it and mailed it. That letter eventually reached Rudy. In the courtroom, the letter became a piece of evidence in the case against John Demjanjuk.
There are 5 rechters in zwarte toga.
There are 5 judges in black robes, there are 5 lawyers in black robes, and there are 10 people plus in the background. Demjanjuk, the Red Cross, the police, and God knows who else looking at that measly 10-cent stamp, which was the ultimate proof because my mother wrote that and that she was on the train to Poland. That was very intense for me.
And that was for me heel heftig.
Rudy is, just like Jules Helvis, one of the Nebenkläger, one of the co-plaintiffs, a citizen who can read their indictment alongside the prosecutor on behalf of the victims. After a trial, he decided to give guest lessons at school about the Holocaust. He says, children must know this. The history of the Holocaust must become a compulsory school subject. We're doing this too little. And if the teachers at school don't do it, then we must do it ourselves.
Ik kan makkelijk praten, ik kan makkelijk in het openbaar praten.
Rudy says, I can talk easily in public. Well, I have children and grandchildren myself, and also 4 great-grandchildren who went to school, so I knew how to handle children at school. But yeah, it becomes a habit at some point. It was more emotional then than now. Now, it's only a rare occasion when I get emotional. Rudy notices that education about the Second World War is declining in quality. There's too little time, he thinks, too little knowledge among teachers. And with that, the interest of the children eventually decreases, he says. In saying this, he highlights how important his voice is to complete the puzzle of the past.
This episode is about passing on war memories and how we should do that when the survivors of the war themselves are no longer here. But how is that possible if those people themselves can only access those memories with great difficulty? Paul Hellmann had to go into hiding as a Jewish child during the war. His father was gassed in Sobibor and his mother was unable to care for him.
Een deel van mijn oorlogsherinneringen zijn weg.
He says part of my war memories are gone. It's strange, even though I was already 7 when we went into hiding. Paul remembers even less of the time before the war, when he still lived with his parents in Rotterdam. He says, but I have those loose memories, as children do. Paul's parents decide to go into hiding, but little Paul has to go to a different address. He goes from one hiding place to another. He only has vague memories, he says.
Toen ben ik uiteindelijk terechtgekomen bij een heel goed adres.
Then I eventually ended up at a very good address at the Veluwe, where I stayed for the rest of the war. So 2.5 years during the war and also 2.5 years after the war. That was at the Krullemuller family. It was a daughter of that Krullemuller family, of the founder of the Krullemuller Park and Museum. Remarkably, that lady had brothers who were with the Germans. They were collaborators. After the war, he ended up with the family of the famous Dutch illustrator Martin Toonder, who created the comic strip Ollie B. Bommel. It's famous in Holland. Sobibor was a word he suddenly learned about at that time.
De eerste keer dat ik ooit van hoorde, ik had nooit van gehoord natuurlijk.
Paul says the first time I ever heard of it, I'd never heard of it of course, was a few years maybe after the war, not so long. Then a note came somehow, I think my mother brought it. This was the note, it says it on here, the word Sobibor. It was an announcement that it had to be assumed that my father had passed away there.
Moest worden dat hij overleden was.
Paul becomes a journalist. He works for a large Dutch newspaper, NRC. He writes about everything, but he leaves his own family history as it is. One day, somewhere in the 70s, someone suddenly brings a large wooden chest to his doorstep. And in that chest are papers, documents, related to the war past of Paul's family. The chest was found in the attic of an antiquarian bookstore in The Hague.
Niemand wist wat ze ermee aan moesten doen en die wilden ze op straat zetten zomaar.
Paul says, nobody knew what to do with it. They wanted to put it on the street just like that. And a lady who lived nearby said, but that just can't happen. I'm going to search and I will find someone who might have need for this chest.
Blij kunnen maken of wat dan ook.
The remarkable thing about the story is that Paul first decides not to investigate that chest further. If I started on that, there's probably no end in it, he thinks. Paul is afraid that he will be thrown off balance by what the papers will reveal. And even though he is a journalist, that chest remains closed for years.
Only years later does he decide to face the past of his family. He investigates how his father was betrayed and how he was deported to Sobibor. When Demjanjuk is indicted in Germany, Paul Helman decides to become one of the Nebenkläger, just like Jules Helvis. He writes a book about that trial, Small Evil, it's called. And the chest opens up. A whole lot of letters, photos, and all kinds of documents.
Paul finds a rich family history of grandparents in Austria who associated with composers and painters. Slowly, the puzzle pieces surface. It's a pity I didn't open the chest sooner, Paul says now.
The proverb says, a picture is worth more than 1,000 words, but sometimes a picture is not complete without the context, without the story, without the statement of an eyewitness. There's a missing puzzle piece that you cannot see. For example,
in the archive of Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the Center for Remembering the Jewish Victims of the Holocaust, there is one unusual photo among the well-known ones of Sobibor. Everything looks new in this photo. It is taken from the tracks and looks out over the camp under construction. In the distance are train wagons, but we see no people where the train stopped. In the distance, men are lugging wood.
The railway tracks in the foreground of the photo draw the most attention. Where grass and plants nowadays shoot up between the rails, in this photo, everything looks pristine, new. Judging by the condition of the buildings in the distance, the men are almost finished with their work. Sobibor looks ready in this photo, ready to receive the first trains.
And yet, there's more to tell about the photograph than you can see in it. That story is about the construction of the camp in the early spring of 1942. Chaim Melzer lives in the village of Sobibor and he witnesses the creation of the camp. He sees the Germans arrive.
They came in a day before or 2 days before Easter. The Germans came with a train from Germany with all the material to build the camp. Then one morning they came into the village. They got from the town 100 men, masons, carpenters, and whatever. And they worked and they made the camp.
Chaim himself is very lucky because he's able to hide and is not taken. The Jewish workmen tell that they are working on the construction of log cabins and also a stone building. We now know that they meant the gas chambers, the only stone building inside the camp.
They were building all the fence and the barracks and those 100 people. The camp was finished 8 weeks later. Those 100 people were the first one to be guessed.
A boy, neighbor of Chaim, who also worked on the construction, hears the Germans talking about gas-tight doors. He begins to suspect what is actually being built and runs away at the last moment. He succeeds in escaping unseen, watches from a distance, and hears the engines of the gas chambers running. Then he sees how the bodies are dragged outside. He tells his fellow villagers how the 100 men met their end.
That's why we knew they were killed, was guessed. From then on, they start to bring the trains. We knew almost every day what was going on there.
Chaim Melcher, a Jewish resident of the village of Sobibor, who hides just in time and survives the war. His story shows how important coincidence is in the transferring of war stories, how much we rely on eyewitness statements. There are no blueprints of Sobibor left, and only a handful of official documents. For important parts of this story, interviews with eyewitnesses are the only source there is.
Nou, ik ben blij om mijn verhaal.
I'm happy to be able to tell my story at various schools, and whether it's group 8, like elementary school or high school students of 15, 16 years old, there is always a lot of discussion about it.
This is Philip Frank. He is someone who tells his war story at school. His story is impressive. He was able to go into hiding as a baby with the help of a resistance group, which placed Philip with foster parents. That literally happened at the very last minute. Philip was already with his parents on the train to Westerbork. At Utrecht City, Maliban station, the train stops, and his parents manage to hand over little Philip and his sister to the resistance group. They manage to escape the German guards at the train with the children and can hand over Philip and his sister to foster parents.
So she came with a baby carriage with a doll in it. And in the other baby carriage was from the resistance fighters. That's how it went. Somewhere near Utrecht, we were handed over to our foster parents, who only had our names and nothing more.
His parents are taken to Sobibor and are gassed there. Only after the war does Philip find out that he also has a sister and that she was placed with other foster parents. The remarkable thing is, they are at school together, but Philip does not know that the girl, who was a few classes higher, was actually his sister. While Rudy Cortizos is critical of the way students are prepared for the lessons he gives, Philip Frank has mostly positive experiences with classes.
They have very good questions, and on top of that, the teachers in such a class where I have contact persons who emails me or calls me a week in advance, they're very prepared. You can notice that they, because there is a lot of documentation now, they know how it went in the war. That is known to that teacher, and they have already discussed it with the class, and they're well prepared. It does me good to tell the story, not my personal story alone, but what it has brought to me and what you must watch out for in the future. I must say, my experience at the schools I have visited now, it's only positive.
Almost everyone who tells about their war experience as a guest teacher shares this experience. You can convey the story, but how important it is, that is difficult to make clear. War is an abstract for many students. War is far away.
De jeugd van nu, als je het hebt over kinderen van,
The youth of today, if you're talking about children of today, they have never experienced a war. That makes it very difficult for those children to understand. What is that, a war? They don't know the feeling. Everything has to be possible nowadays. I see it in my own children and grandchildren too. But I also fortunately have few children and grandchildren who are very interested in that story, who also want to know. And I noticed that at school too. There is a lot, but that also depends on the class itself and the teacher or the instructor who does it.
According to him, the strength of education about the persecution of the Jews lies in the personal story. Take students along a life story, says Philip, and leave the numbers for what they are.
Je moet geen aantallen noemen van 6 miljoen Joden.
When you begin, you shouldn't mention numbers. You shouldn't throw at them the number of 6 million Jews so or many concentration camps that and what the differences are between concentration camps and extermination camps. All those things you shouldn't mention. You must bring your own personal story because that does get through to those children. That's my experience, at least. Then they are suddenly very, oh, sir, we didn't know that, and it's impressive to see the pictures. I occasionally have to add some more pictures to my story. I've been alerted to that, and that's only good, and not those numbers. What does it say to them that 100,000 Jewish Dutch people were gassed or murdered? That says nothing to them. So that kind of numbers, that brings those children no information at all. But my story does.
Some eyewitnesses have not only told their story, but also written it down. Only, books are simply being read less and less, especially by young people. How do you reach them when the people with their personal war experience are no longer there after some time? Should we then perhaps rely on TV interviews?
For the TV documentary The Long Way Home, director Mark Harris spoke with Jewish survivors about the period just after the liberation. And that's noteworthy because in most documentaries, that is the moment where the story ends. Many of the statements in the documentary are about the region around Sobibor, so that makes it interesting for us.
A Jewish man tells the camera that he was taken from Sobibor as a forced laborer to other camps and thus survived the war.
Our houses were destroyed because after we were deported, the Gentiles started to search for gold. They razed the houses and dug pits to look for it. I met one man who I'd known before the war, and he asked me, "Why did the Germans leave you alive? Why didn't they turn you into soap?"
In the program, a Jew from Vlodava is also interviewed, a village near Camp Sobibor. In Vlodava, almost the entire Jewish population was deported to Sobibor and gassed. That was three-quarters of the village's population. The Jewish man manages to escape deportation and returns to the village only to find out that there's no one from his family that survived the war. The other Polish residents view him with a sort of suspicion, he tells in the film.
"We were hated because we returned from the dead. They looked upon us as ghosts. No one loves ghosts."
The Long Way Home tells a very different story of the period after liberation than the Dutch story. Here you see in films and documentaries cheering boys and girls climbing onto a Canadian tank. Everyone is happy. In Poland, the atmosphere is very different. There is doubt among the population about what the arrival of the Soviet soldiers will entail. And then there's something else. The years of anti-Semitic propaganda in Poland were not simply undone. Anti-Jewish prejudices were not gone immediately.
An example of this is what happened in the Polish city of Kielce. In July 1946, about a few hundred kilometers from Sobibor. There, The remaining Jewish community was accused of involvement in the kidnapping of a Christian child. The Jews were said to have murdered babies. No evidence, just gossip. Angry Polish residents forced their way into a building where Jewish war refugees lived and murdered 42 Jews. The news spread like wildfire that the police and the army also participated in the anti-Jewish violence. For many Jews, it ended the hope that they could resume their old life in Poland. That same month, 12,000 Jews decided to leave Poland for good. And it didn't stop there. Of the 300,000 Jews who returned from the camps, the majority left Poland for good in the years that followed.
Poland has since realized that they had to do something about this. There is now a large museum about Jewish history in Warsaw. Outside, guides lead people around the ghettos and the Aktion Reinhardt camps. This sometimes brings up an unpopular part of Polish history, in which the stories take on a grim undertone. There is another puzzle piece of the history of Sobibor that until now has only been briefly described in history books. That concerns Traniki, a camp in the same Lublin region where guards like John Damianiuk could learn how to keep Jewish prisoners down with violence. You literally learned how to torture people. Jews died here in a horrific way.
When the gas chambers of Sobibor are blown up and the camp is closed, there are still Jewish prisoners in the Travniki camp, as well as in the work camps in the vicinity. Himmler gives the order to murder all the remaining Jewish prisoners. 43,000 prisoners are shot. Author Willem Hendrik Gispen wrote the book Name Their Names about the Aktion Reinhardt camps, together with illustrator Jeroen Hermkens. He says that giant pits were dug right in front of the barracks in Travniki after that massacre.
En daar zijn die mensen dan in, ja.
Those people were then dumped in here. They weren't buried, you understand. They were thrown in. It's very strange when you're there now. Actually, you're standing on a spot there, a neat lawn now, but you're actually standing on mass graves. I found that so unbelievably contrasting in Traniki. You're standing there now, it's cleaned up. There's a small playground, people are having a cozy barbecue, but you're in fact standing in the Second World War.
Bernolf Kramer is a researcher and board member of the Sobibor Foundation. He has been to Travniki several times and remains bewildered by how the site around, but especially on top of the mass graves, is laid out nowadays.
One of the places that has everything to do with Sobibor. The training ground where also many Dutch Jews and refugees were murdered. There is still a playground on top of the mass grave here in the year 2025. So after the uprising on November 3rd, the remaining Jews in the central government were murdered. And there we find a playground on top of the mass grave. To this day.
Recent research by archaeologist Caroline Sturdy Coles under the houses of the village of Travniki showed dungeons in which Jews were held are still there. Some residents use them as storage. On the walls in the cellars, the team of archaeologists found all kinds of inscriptions from, among others, Jewish prisoners. An undiscovered part of history, simply because the doors of the cellars had been closed for years.
We ourselves, meanwhile, have gotten hold of a piece of the history of Sobibor. These are previously unknown photos and documents coming from a Russian website. They tell how the soldiers of the Red Army find the campsite of Sobibor in 1944 and what the surrounding residents and survivors say about the camp. We are reading more and more of the massive pile of documents.
What strikes us are the conversations with the survivors, the prisoners who managed to escape during the uprising. A number of them were working in what is called Lager 2, at the barracks where victims' belongings were sorted. Until now, there was still some doubt as to whether that group of Jews knew exactly what was happening further on in the camp, because no one was allowed there, the gas chambers. But in these statements, you read the despair about their own situation, says Bernhoff Kramer from the Sobibor Foundation.
When I read those documents, the people who are working in Lager 2 realize that fairly quickly, and that the chance of survival was actually nil and based on coincidence.
We read stories about Jews who were killed by the SS for arbitrary reasons. Bernhoff Kramer finds that the Russian documents primarily show that the Red Army was already informed in detail about what was happening in Sobibor right after taking the area in 1944. Only years later did that information become known in the Netherlands.
Well, actually, those reports are very detailed about what happens with the train that arrives, how Lager 2 worked, what happened in Lager 3. That's all named in very detailed descriptions. Well, we didn't actually know that here, immediately after the war. Yes, it's there, written in black and white.
Ja, dat staat daar wel zwart op wit.
But if you want to complete the puzzle of the past, it's not even just about new parts you can add to the war story. It's also about how we look at the main characters, how we have come to interpret their roles. We've shown in this series how war films can give us more understanding about the seriousness of the war. Only Hollywood has done also something with the way we have started to categorize perpetrators and victims, how we see them.
The German professor Harald Welzer is a social psychologist. He has spent years studying the way perpetrators viewed their own actions after the Holocaust. According to him, we must guard against the story about camps like Sobibor slowly turning into a film script, where the main characters are divided into pure good and evil. Welzer says, about such a villain, we no longer ask ourselves how he became that way. He has turned into a movie character, and that means we no longer see his story as reality.
Welzer looked, among others, at German camp guards of Sobibor. He investigated where they came from and concluded that they were almost all ordinary citizens who were slowly pushed into these positions. They are not trained killers, but people who have civilian jobs like taxi drivers or plumbers. They can be described as completely normal men in every respect.
Sie entsprechen nicht dem Hollywood-Bild. Vom Nazi-Täter.
They don't fit the Hollywood image of Nazi perpetrators. There we have the image of the henchman, who's not particularly intelligent and who has actually nothing else in mind than killing as many people as possible. The persons in the historical reality are completely different. We're dealing in part with people with double doctorates among the Einsatzgruppen leaders. They mostly come from the bourgeoisie. They are educated. They are almost subtle people with whom you could certainly have parlayed about Mozart or Beethoven.
Auch über Mozart oder Beethoven hätte parlieren können.
So how is it possible that they were capable of gassing other people? Welzer attributes that in part to the years in which Jews were presented as a problem, as inferior, as a population with criminal intentions.
The first step to mass murder is a categorical distinction between us and them. Everyone notices that people lose their jobs and they have to leave their homes, that their belongings are auctioned off and that businesses are, as it is called, Aryanized and so on. All this is a public process. It's not a secret process. And this process naturally stabilized the demarcation. Those are them, while we are the others.
Das sind die, während wir die anderen sind.
In the previous episode, we described how camp commander Franz Stangl said he was called up to report to Lublin, near Sobibor. What he was going to do there was supposedly unclear to him once he had already arrived at the camp itself. In his story, he carefully avoids the moment he decides to stay, that he accepts the job. According to Harald Welzer, it is not so much that men like Frank Stangl made the wrong choice, they made no choice at all. Afterwards, they tried to find an explanation. Why did I actually do that?
It's really so that an incredible amount simply happens situationally and reflection comes afterwards. The reflection is also what we later get through eyewitness interviews and such. That is to say, categories such as exclusion, racism, or whatever are much more present at the level of the action itself and behavior itself than the level of a reflective attitude. The thing lies in practice. That is, I believe, the decisive point to understand how people act. In the moment itself, when we are faced with a horrific task, that part of your brain takes the lead that determines whether or not you are capable of doing what is asked. The question of whether or not you actually want to perform the task, the ethical question, can quickly come subordinate to the practical question, can I do this? Especially if that ethical question, should I do it, involves danger for your own survival. Passing on the correct story about Sobibor is important for several reasons, and one of them is to ensure that lies don't get a chance. Holocaust deniers constantly try to sow doubt, including what happened in Sobibor. That already started with the blowing up of the gas chambers. The first Holocaust deniers were the Nazis themselves.
Without fake news, Hitler would never have come to power, says American historian Timothy Ryback. He states that the stream of daily lies ensured that more and more people slowly started to believe a little more in a future with the Nazi Party in power. Individually, people might only accept 20% of everything Hitler proclaimed. But when more and more people felt addressed by a part of the message, he could still get large followers, says Ryback. It is a plea for the correct information, the truth about Sobibor.
We must also talk about the place Sobibor has become now. It was once a place that made clear to everyone what total destruction of the Jewish people meant. The goal of Sobibor was not only that the Jews would no longer live, but also that they would cease to exist as dead people. Their bodies were burned, their bones were ground to dust. Even their grave was not allowed to be there.
How did that go? That change from first an extermination camp, then partly dog walking spot and children's playground, then an archaeological excavation site, and finally the solemn memorial place it is now. How did that come about?
You'll hear more about this in the next episode.
Every episode of this podcast series ends with Ben Oranje. He writes poems, or spoken word if you will. And just like you now, he has heard this episode, and this is what he heard.
Villagers in the forest created a machine. Cabins, checkouts, barbers. A conveyor belt with no brakes. They witnessed firsthand what it means. What comes to an end. You have just 1 hour. Homeward is a ghost story. Eyes burn. Thoughts hiss, smoking you out. The spirit of age died a million times. The marching on Polish ground brought it all up. And now, the time is here. If you listened well, my grandfather in the resistance. Soon no one will be able to say that anymore. Who are you? Between Mozart and murdering machine, there is also a beating heart. And yet, our age carries the burden of millions, the burn marks in our civilization. It suits no one, yet people wear it, tailored, measured, even today. Us and them still makes them man.